So what did Hochul call it? A conceptual conceptual framework?
She said they have the parameters of a conceptual agreement.
All right. Okay, so of those parameters, what's on the table this year? We had a lot of advocates on both sides, developer-landlord side being one, tenant on the other, trying to push through things that they have been trying to push through for years at this point. So some replacement for 421A, some form of good cause eviction, some provisions that could change the 2019 rent law a little bit, and then something for office to residential conversions.
Good morning. It's Monday, April 22nd, and this is Deconstruct, a podcast from The Real Deal. I'm Isabella Farr.
And I'm Susanna Cavanaugh. Today, we are digging into New York's much-anticipated housing deal. As of last week, we got one, sort of. So we got a leaked framework for one that includes provisions for a 421A replacement. That's the tax incentive that allows for development. A version of good cause eviction, a tweak to the 2019 rent law, and a policy intended to incentivize office to residential conversions. This is huge because many of these proposals have been on the docket for years. So we'll hear from Catherine Brunzel, who has also been covering this for years, on what we got and what it means for development, tenants, and rent-stabilized landlords in New York City.
Definitely a lot to cover there. But first, let's go over the news of last week. I'm going to start with some discounted office deals. First, in New York, David Werner bought 100 Wall Street in the financial district for about $115 million. And compared to its last sale price, that was a steal. The seller was Barings Real Estate, and Barings paid about $270 million nearly 10 years ago for the building. It was actually reported to be a record at the time for an office building in FIDI east of Broadway. That's a very specific niche area, but it was a record. So anyway, the deal did come out to a roughly 57% discount from last sale price.
Okay. And if you didn't know, David Werner recently teamed with Nathan Berman, who is the office residential king, also called the king of FIDI at some point, to convert Pfizer's former headquarters in Midtown into apartments.
Just to be clear, we don't know if Berman is involved in this deal, and it is unclear if 100 Wall Street is an office to resi play, but it's definitely a possibility given his history. Okay, on to the second discounted deal. New York Life Real Estate Investors and a company called Bridgeton, they're based out of New York, bought an office building in San Francisco for $22 million.
Okay, the suspense. How much did the seller buy it for?
Almost $86 million in 2019, so a roughly 75% discount there.
Yeah, ooh, okay. It's funny because so there was this NYU report that came out. I think NYU wrote it with Columbia, and that was last year. And they said that New York City's offices would lose 44% of their pre-pandemic values by 2029. And I think that was even an update to the year before where it was a lower percentage. So it just keeps ticking up. But, you know, I'm sure there were other reports for other office markets where numbers may have been similar. And, you know, we're definitely starting to see that anecdotally.
Right. Boston Consulting Group had estimated LA offices would lose up to 55% of value over the next 5 years. And to your point, we've definitely seen some deeper cuts than those initial projections or estimates.
Okay. On to other distressed news. Harry Macklow, one of the biggest names in New York City real estate, is on the brink of losing two projects. One is in Miami and another is in Midtown in New York. Fortress Investment Group has filed to foreclose on the two sites, and according to marketing materials for the foreclosure, Macklow has about $41 million in unpaid debt on each property.
Can you talk about what Macklow had planned to build on those sites?
So in Midtown, he once planned a super tall office tower across three plots that would have cost $1 billion. It's unclear what happened to those plans, but they seem to be off the table. And in Miami, Macklow's site is approved for 770 residential units across two towers. And that was actually his first
you know, major buy in South Florida.
It'll be interesting to see whether he pulls a last-ditch effort to save the properties from foreclosure somehow, or whether he's just willing to walk away. It'll also be, I'm really interested in, you know, tracking like every event of distress at this point. Like, from foreclosure, does the lender put it up for sale? Do you know, do they take over the project? Do they file new plans? We're going to start to see a lot of that as the distress makes its way through the system. Okay, last piece of news, because we have a big New York housing deal to get through. A $63 million spec home in Los Angeles has sold, marking the most expensive resi deal that LA has seen so far this year. We don't have confirmation on who the buyer is yet, but the buyer entity is registered to an immigration firm in the San Francisco Bay Area, plus a corporation registered in the British Virgin Islands. So again, nothing is confirmed, but it's possible and probably likely that the buyer is from overseas, and they did pay in all cash, so there was no mortgage on the property.
Okay. What was the listing price there?
$78 million. It was first listed in October. So I'll weigh in and say that the property sold relatively quickly for a mansion at that price point. We've definitely seen some at higher price points sit on the market for a year, sometimes 2 years, with just deepened price cuts. But you know, with $78 million, there was still some aspirational pricing there. It is unclear how much the developers, Brandon and Deborah Schoenfeld, actually spent on construction, but they bought the site for about $11 million, so I think we can assume there was some profit there.
Alrighty, let's transition into our interview with Catherine Brenzel, senior reporter at The Real Deal and New York City housing policy expert.
So we got this week, finally, a housing deal, or at least the framework for a housing deal, right? Okay, so we're recording this Wednesday afternoon, and as of now, there are going to be delays in the final version, we just found out, right?
Potentially. So there was a cyber attack, apparently, that targeted the budget bill drafting office. So far, officials have said that they don't think it's going to delay anything, but we're waiting to see.
So what did Hochul call it? A conceptual... conceptual framework?
She said they have the parameters of a conceptual agreement.
All right. Okay, so of those parameters, what's on the table this year? We had a lot of advocates on both sides, developer-landlord side being one, tenant on the other, trying to push through things that they have been trying to push through for years at this point. So some replacement for 421A, some form of good cause eviction, some provisions that could change the 2019 rent law a little bit, and then something for office to residential conversion. So let's start with 421A. What does the deal include to replace 421A? And I'll say 421A is a tax abatement that allows new multifamily buildings to be built.
Yeah, so it's now referred to as 485X, so I'll have to just somehow remember that. And basically, it's, you know, as with the last program, it's going to require set aside affordable housing. Right now, it's, I think it's 20 to 25%. There are a few different income ranges for that. So it's either 60% of the area median income, and that's an average, or 80% of the area median income. The way that's different from the previous program is that there was a higher income level that was permitted under the last program. It was 130% of the area median income.
Which was quite high.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that that was, you know, there was sort of recognition, I think, you know, from the development side too, that like the affordability levels needed to change in the new program. Mm-hmm. My sense is that I don't think they're crazy about where things landed on that, but more especially on the construction wage side of things.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, I think we were expecting there to be adjustments to the affordability levels. I'm not sure that anyone necessarily expected it to land here.
So talk a little bit more about the construction wage side of things, because I know that seemed to be holding up negotiations for a while. There was back and forth with REBNY, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, the governor had basically left it to REBNY and the building trades to kind of come to an agreement on what construction workers can be paid, should be paid on these projects. You know, it seemed like those two groups really couldn't come to an agreement on their own. The governor intervened, and it seems like they largely went with what the unions were asking for.
Okay.
They wanted the construction wages to be a percentage of prevailing wage rates. Mm-hmm. REBNY was pushing for an average, which was the same as what the previous program had, but they were calling for increases to those wages. There's also a wage floor that applies citywide that was won by the laborers union, but some of the higher paid construction workers weren't too thrilled with that.
So the wages that the trade unions got, will those be prohibitive to new development under 485X? Is there any talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, REBNY has basically come out and said that they believe this program is going to lead to less housing development than the previous program. I mean, I think it's hard to say right now when we don't actually have the bill language in front of us. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to depend on location as well. What I'm hearing so far is, you know, I spoke to a few real estate attorneys this week who are basically saying they're talking to clients. They're going to see, you know, what works for each individual project.
Okay, so it could be project by project.
Yeah.
Moving on to tenant protections, we also got a version of good cause eviction. And it is notably different than the good cause bill that was first proposed or introduced in 2019, right? So what would you say the key differences are there?
Yeah, so with this proposal that's on the table, tenants can challenge an eviction if their rent is increased by 10% or 5% plus inflation, whichever is less. This version also includes a number of carve-outs for higher-priced buildings, for new construction. I believe there's also a portfolio exemption, you know, for property owners who have a relatively small portfolio. There's been a lot of backlash on the tenant side from this. City Limits just had a report that said that tens of thousands of units could be exempt under that exemption alone, the portfolio size.
Wow.
So, you know, there are some tenant groups were basically saying they'd prefer lawmakers to walk away from this deal than even pass this version of good cause. For a while now, we've been operating under the assumption that some kind of change needed to be made to the 2019 mm-hmm. law for it to move forward, just because it, you know, it had been introduced year after year, hadn't really moved forward. But I think that tenant advocates were hoping for, you know, fewer concessions to be built into this.
Because the 2019 law, remind me if this is right, but was it 3% and then 1.5% plus inflation?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. So this is, you know, this is a divergence.
It's considerably higher. Yeah.
Okay. That seems extreme that the tenant side was willing to say, like, no, we don't want it at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think last year there was a discussion about doing a version that was closer to the California version, which is the 10%, 5 plus, you know, a higher cap, basically.
Right.
But I think that the additional exemptions is where they really was kind of a breaking point for them, I think.
How did landlords feel?
You know, I think, you know, I don't think they were happy about it by any means. But, you know, I think that honestly, there was a bigger backlash against the changes to the rent law, specifically the individual apartment improvement program, which allows landlords to increase rents on stabilized apartments if they renovate the apartments. They were upset about those changes because they didn't feel like they went far enough. I don't know if there's an expectation here that they would kind of get more out of this trade-off if, you know, in a bill package that included good cause, but they were not happy where things landed on that.
Yeah, let's get into the individualized apartment improvements, also called, we'll call them IAIs going forward. So they're a bit wonky. So work with me through this if you can. So the 2019 rent law said that you can only spend $15,000 on renovations and recoup the cost of those renovations over a 15-year period. But the cost you could recoup is a very small percentage of what you actually spent. So the idea there is that you're not going to be able to raise rents enough to make these renovations make sense. And there's also an issue where there are a number of vacant rent stabilized apartments in the city that landlords need to put a lot of money into in order to bring them back online. So the IAIs that we got are what?
It's a tiered system. For the most part, I think like most apartments that would be, you know, eligible for this, they would see that 15,000 threshold go up to 30,000. Mm-hmm. There is an option for it to go up to 50,000. But I believe that that's only applies to apartments that have been, you know, continuously occupied for, I think it was like
25 years.
Yeah. Okay. And then, and there's some confusion about like what that will entail exactly, if that means the same tenant or like different tenants over time. And also for certain apartments that have been, you know, vacant in recent years, that could also apply. It's still a fraction of that cost that you're able to pass on. The key difference here, though, is that these, as of right now, the proposal on the table, these would be permanent, whereas they were not permanent under the 2019 rent law.
You mentioned that landlords felt that that didn't go far enough. Why do they think that?
Yeah, I mean, I think initially, the proposal that had been put on the table was $150,000, which is, you know, I think it was a non-starter for a number of lawmakers. You know, I think just given the level of distress in some of these buildings, the like high volume of vacancies that have been reported, they're feeling that, you know, even with these increases, like that's not enough to cover the amount of, you know, repairs that are needed on some of these properties. I think from the lawmaker's perspective, I talked to Senator Kavanaugh earlier this month, and he was saying that he felt like, you know, some of the descriptions of the distress is overblown, but I think it really depends on who you talk to about the level of distress that we're seeing. So
right. Yeah. It's landlord to landlord. I mean, some folks that I've talked to are saying, you know, I need to do gut renovations. It's going to be $130,000. I know the lead abatement is, that's like a serious undertaking. And some of these units are very old and they have people who may have lived in them for, let's say, 60 years and then vacated. So there's a lot of work to be done is the owner's argument. In that vein, CHIP, the Community Housing Improvement Program, which is a landlord group, has a bill that they were hoping would do something a little bit more helpful for landlords. We framed it as a vacancy reset, and it would be a way to, they believe, bring some of these units back online. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that bill is and if it has legs given this IAI provision that was included in the budget?
Yeah, so CHIP's bill would have allowed landlords to reset rents on units once they've become vacant. There was a requirement that it had to have been occupied for a certain amount of time. The unit would remain stabilized after that increase. In terms of its chances going forward, I think because of, you know, all of the pushback against this IAI increase, I think because it sort of got lumped in with all the discussion about IAI, which was framed as a broader just rollback of the 2019 rent law. I think because it got wrapped up in that narrative, I think its chances, at least for now, are not great. You know, I think it was facing an uphill battle going into this session, but I think now it's going to be some time before they're able to really push on that again. I'm sure that's not going to stop them from you know, pushing for it, but with the response to these changes to the IAIs on the tenant side, I think it's going to be hard to get another change through at this point.
Yeah. What was the response from the tenant side?
I mean, they thought this was, you know, a full-blown rollback of 2019.
Which is overblown. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's definitely an adjustment from what passed in 2019. The IAI increase combined with the replacement of 421A, the extension to the expired 421A, the lifting of the you know, residential density cap in the city. Tenants are framing that as, you know, overall this housing package is a giveaway to developers and all they got in exchange was this watered down good cause. So that's sort of the way this is being framed.
Right. Like my mom went to the Bahamas and all she brought back was this t-shirt. Okay. So you mentioned the lifting of the residential density cap. So that is like an office to residential help possibly for conversions. So what happened there and how would that help?
Yeah. So right now you can't build, for the most part, you can't build residential space in the city that's larger than 12 times the size of the lot you're building on. So that's an FAR cap of 12. The state controls that. State has to lift that cap in order for the city to rezone areas to then allow for higher residential space. As things stand, you know, it seems like the state is poised to do that, and the city will then move forward with a separate proposal to potentially move forward with these rezonings. But it does open the door for more office conversions because a lot of office space is already bigger than FAR 12. So, you know, if they were to try to convert under current rules, they could only convert the office space up to 12 into residential, and the rest of the space would have to remain something else.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So it's just like not a feasible situation at the moment. But yeah, so I mean, it seems like state's going to do that. There might be other restrictions on it. We're still waiting on the budget bills at this point.
Last question. Do we expect, of what we know, what you know you've gathered so far, are there going to be any other changes to what we've learned about what this housing deal is between now and when it's actually finalized?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely a number of proposals that like have been previously talked about that we haven't received details on. So like, I think there'll be things that haven't been talked about that we'll learn about. And I think also, you know, earlier this week, I was still hearing some changes to the new 421A program. So, I mean, I think it's totally possible that some things will change, but yeah, we're still waiting.
Deconstruct airs every Monday on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Or you can listen at therealdeal.com. For comments on this episode or on the series, or if you have a guest or idea you'd like to pitch, feel free to reach me or Susanna at podcasts@therealdeal.com. Next week, we're talking about legislation set to boost office to residential conversions. Tune in then.